Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When you're not opening presents this holiday season, try smashing your way through some tricky chocolate-coated levels on Candy Crush Saga. In between dinner and dessert, switch and match. During one of Uncle Mike's long stories, master the candy. There are thousands of levels to play in the all-time favorite classic Match 3 game. Get that sweet feeling this holiday with Candy Crush Saga. Download it now from the App Store or Google Play for free.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 24th of December, these are our main stories. Boeing has sacked its chief executive as the company struggles to deal with the impact of two deadly plane crashes blamed on the firm's computer software. A UN official has accused Saudi Arabia of making a mockery of justice over death sentences imposed for the killing of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And a Romanian court has controversially acquitted a group of Roma men charged with trafficking hundreds of children. Also in this podcast. Vladimir Putin has opened a railway bridge connecting the annexed Crimea region directly to Russia. First to the world of aviation and business.
The Boeing 737 MAX is one of those decisions. The aircraft is purpose-built to deliver and secure that future prosperity. How? Let's start with efficiency. The MAX uses 13% less fuel than current 737s. That's a lot less fuel. A lot less. The new 737 MAX.
An excerpt from a promotional video for the Boeing 737 MAX aircraft in 2013. Since then, the Boeing company has run into many problems. On Monday, it fired its chief executive, Dennis Muilenburg, who had been heavily criticised over two fatal crashes involving the company's 737 MAX aircraft. Boeing has been struggling to deal with the impact of the crashes, blamed on onboard computer software, in which nearly 350 people died. The entire fleet has been grounded since March. Here's Dennis Muilenburg speaking before a Senate committee in October this year. He was asked why the company had allowed the 737 MAX to fly.
It's something that we've spent a lot of time thinking about over the last year. And we have a keen sense of responsibility. We're responsible for our airplanes. And any accident with one of our airplanes is unacceptable. And we've reviewed both of these accidents. We know what needs to be fixed. We own that. We have a responsibility to do that. That's exactly what we're doing. And we're confident with the updates that we're making that once the MAX returns to the skies, it'll be one of the safest airplanes ever to fly.
Our New York business correspondent is Samira Hussein, and I asked her what went wrong for Dennis Muilenburg.
Pretty much everything. He was really unable to really sort of control the narrative when it came to everything that happened after the initial crisis began. So he was never really able to be sympathetic enough to the victims. He was accused by U.S. lawmakers when he went to go testify of putting profits over the safety of passengers. He wasn't clear to any of the airlines in terms of when these planes would start flying again. In fact, many of the airlines expressed a lot of frustration with Mr. Muilenburg, saying that he would continue on saying that, oh, it'll be just a few weeks and just a few weeks again, making it impossible for these airlines to do any forward planning. And foremost, he was not direct with U.S. regulators. He wasn't giving them the kind of paperwork that they wanted. He wasn't giving them the kind of information that they wanted. And ultimately, that meant that he had to go as head of the company.
So he's out. What next for Boeing?
Well, what's next is that they really need to try and get its most profitable plane, the 737 MAX, back up in the air again. And that's going to be the absolute focus of the new CEO, Mr. Calhoun, when he takes office in January. The other focus, of course, is going to be rebuilding the reputation of this very storied American company, a reputation that has been very badly damaged in the eyes of its colleagues and in the eyes of the public.
Samira Hussein in New York. It was one of the most shocking crimes of last year, the murder of the prominent Saudi government critic Jamal Khashoggi. He was killed inside the kingdom's consulate in the Turkish city of Istanbul by a team of Saudi agents. On Monday, a court in Saudi Arabia sentenced five people to death and jailed three others. The Saudi authorities have concluded that the murder was as a result of what they called a rogue operation. That's been squarely contradicted by UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Execution, Agnès Callamard, who described the verdict as a travesty of investigation, prosecution and justice. She told the BBC that the Saudi statement lacked all credibility.
I do not believe for one moment that the dismemberment of a body can be done in the spur of the moment. I do not believe for one second that the presence of a forensic doctor was an accident. And I certainly do not believe for a moment that the same doctor speaking of dismemberment 2 hours before the killing and dismemberment actually happened was accidental.
Tim Franks spoke to our security correspondent and Middle East specialist Frank Gardner and asked him how this Saudi court operates.
The entire trial has been held in great secrecy. It started in January this year. We were never actually given the names of the people on trial, but it very quickly transpired that one of the chief suspects and somebody suspected by the CIA as being involved in this, somebody called Sadr Ghartani, was not even arrested. There were rumours he was under house arrest, then he'd been seen in the royal court. And he is somebody who certainly Western intelligence agencies suspect had a major hand in this whole operation. The other person is the deputy head of Saudi intelligence, Ahmed Al-Asiri, a two-star major general who came from the military. And he was alleged to have orchestrated the whole operation from Saudi Arabia, from Riyadh. He was put on trial, but has been acquitted. So there's quite a lot of outrage from people who've been watching this, and I would say watching the trial, but there's been nothing to watch because it's been so tightly held in secrecy. And I think Agnès Callamard has put it very, very neatly when she says the hitmen have been convicted, the five actual hitmen, but the masterminds, as she put it, have walked free. So I think the cloud of suspicion that has fallen over Saudi Arabia because of this is not going to be dispelled by these verdicts. And to his great credit, the Saudi ambassador to London, Prince Khalid Al Saud, in an interview that he did with us with the BBC a few months ago, he called this whole murder a stain on Saudi Arabia's reputation. I don't think that these verdicts will wipe away that stain.
Well, you and you quote him describing it as a stain. Do you think it has had long-term implications, though, for the government of Saudi Arabia, and in particularly for the Crown Prince?
Very much so, yes, absolutely. I mean, the Crown Prince was fated with an E. You know, he was celebrated and welcomed from Hollywood to Washington to Berlin to London to Paris. He was the great hope. And in some ways, he still is, weirdly, for social change in Saudi Arabia. And this is the extraordinary thing, is that on the one hand, he is opening up Saudi Arabia, modernizing it, bringing in new ideas. There are raves in Riyadh from time to time. There are boxing matches. There are cinemas. Women and men can mix freely. Saudi Arabia is joining the 21st century in social terms. And yet at the same time, he is cracking down worse than ever on any form of political dissent. There is no political freedom. People are being banged up for tweets, for the slightest call for transparency and democracy. So it's moving in kind of simultaneously. It's almost like two tectonic plates moving in opposite directions. And there's no question that the Khashoggi murder has damaged Saudi Arabia's international standing. The smart Saudis know this. It's hurt the Aramco flotation. It's hurt their whole plans for the Vision 2030 to modernise the country.
That was Frank Gardner. The HBO Sky TV series Chernobyl won three Emmys and brought the story of the 1986 nuclear disaster in Ukraine to a new audience. But the woman at the centre of it, Lyudmila Ignatenko, the wife of one of the first firefighters to die, says she never gave HBO permission to tell her story and claims that she's had to go into hiding due to media harassment. In her first interview since the series aired, she spoke to Olga Molchevska of BBC Russian.
For the viewing public, it's a window on the past. The worst nuclear disaster in living history, when reactor number 4 in Chernobyl in Ukraine blew up. But for Людмила Игнатенко, the series relives a horrific time in her life when she had to watch her firefighter husband die from radiation poisoning. After the HBO series aired, Людмила says the media attention and scrutiny was so intense that she had to leave Kyiv. For half a year, she has been in hiding in a remote village in the countryside. She has agreed to talk to us as long as we don't reveal her location.
Journalists were constantly pestering me. It was very stressful, and I feel offended that my story has been distorted.
What exactly did they distort?
That I had killed my baby. They were asking why I had been at my husband's bedside knowing that I was pregnant at the time. But tell me, how could I leave him? I thought my baby was safe inside me. We didn't know anything about radiation then.
Людмила's baby died 4 hours after being born. She says she never gave HBO permission to tell her story.
I think the film company behaved very badly by not meeting me, especially since they were filming in Kyiv. There was a phone call from Moscow. They said they were filming in Latvia and in Kyiv and wanted to contact me, but they couldn't. The movie was already filmed by then. They said, we'll pay you $3,000. Sorry, but what for? Just because you exist, they said. I told them that nobody pays money for nothing, and hung up. Of course I thought it was fake, some sort of fraud. I could not understand what was going on and what they were offering me money for.
Did the fact that they were calling from a Moscow number somehow influence your perception of the situation?
Yes, because there is a war in my country, the conflict with Russia, and there was a call from Russia.
HBO disputes this.
The production team, via local representatives, had multiple exchanges with Людмила Игнатенко. At no point during these exchanges did she express that she did not wish her story or that of her husband Vasily to be included. The filmmakers made every effort to depict their story and that of everyone affected by this tragedy with authenticity and respect.
It's a misunderstanding that has left Людмила feeling isolated. She has only caught snippets of the series when it was broadcast on Ukrainian television.
It was very hard to watch, and there were lies in the movie. Me standing with his shoes in my hands. Yes, they buried Vasily with his shoes off, but the shoes were beside him.
But the attention to detail in some parts moved her.
People were really so lightly dressed.
Did you see the actress that played you?
Yes, in the trailer.
It's Jessie Buckley. Do you think she looks like you?
I guess so.
Is she beautiful?
You know better. I had a similar grey jumper.
I asked her about a moment in the film where Vasily had brought her flowers in the hospital.
Yes, it was 1st of May. I shall remember until the end of my life how we stood by the window together. We did not know that it would be our last moment together.
Some 33 years after the Chernobyl disaster, their wedding day photo still has pride of place in her home and her heart. She never remarried.
That report was by Olga Malchevska. 25 Roma men accused of masterminding the trafficking of hundreds of children to beg and steal in Europe have been acquitted at a final appeal hearing in Romania. A court in Târgu Mureș in central Romania said prosecutors had failed to present evidence. Here's our Europe regional editor, Mike Sanders.
The acquittals come as a bitter disappointment to those who've been working on the case for more than a decade. It centres on the village of Tsundere in southeastern Romania, where grandiose villas stand in stark contrast to the surrounding poverty. More than 1,000 children from the village were trafficked around Europe. They were forced to commit crimes to enrich their handlers. British police identified 181 such children in the UK. Bernie Gravett, who's now a consultant on human trafficking, led the British investigation.
We convicted 120 people in the UK of child trafficking, child neglect, child exploitation, money laundering, benefit fraud, and a range of other crimes. Yet Romania have not convicted a single individual.
Nearly a decade ago, British police took part in raids on suspects' homes in Sundaray. Bernie Gravett says they found large sums of cash and jewellery, AK-47 assault rifles, and what he calls the trappings of organised crime. So even if witness statements had weakened over time, he says, convictions should still have been possible.
Where has the evidence gone? You know, I physically saw the truckloads of evidence that went to the first court in Harghita County in Romania back in 2010. I know the evidence is there. I've seen it with my own eyes. So the question has to be said, what happened to it? If it has disappeared, where's it gone?
There's consternation in Romania too. The European Centre for Legal Education and Research in Bucharest called the lack of convictions a huge failure of the Romanian justice system.
That was Mike Saunders. Thousands of Australian firefighters, many of them volunteers, have been putting their lives on the line as they tackle the country's catastrophic bushfires. And now the question's being asked, is it time to pay them for their service? Two volunteers have died in recent weeks. Many more have been injured and are struggling with the emotional and physical toll. Australians have been paying tribute to their bravery. Some firefighters have started sharing their experiences.
We said, all right, guys, we'll see you tomorrow morning, because we were coming back to relieve them as the next dark force. And they were killed not long after that.
My memory slips back to a few days ago when a man broke down and I was holding him in my arms as he sobbed, having experienced 70 metre flame height.
It wasn't until the blaze was pretty much brought under control that the team member came and told me that my house was on fire.
And what was going through your mind?
At that time, not a lot, because we didn't have time to think about that.
An RFS captain lost her own home, and 24 hours later she was back fighting the fires. It's just extraordinary.
On the Saturday, there was a call put out for additional support and volunteers. 1,000 turned up extra. 1,000.
The BBC's Henry Bellow told us more about the volunteers.
Jackie, there's 200,000 volunteers. That makes it the biggest volunteer firefighting service anywhere in the world. These are men and women who actually live in the communities that are battling these fires. So that means that they're on the front line. They're trying to defend their own homes as well as the homes of their neighbours as well. They've got regular jobs. They're everyday members of the community. Some of them are doctors, teachers, nurses. We've got farmers, all walks of life. The one common thing is that they give up their time. They give up their time away from work and in some cases away from payment to try and fight these fires. They do it, yes, because there's a sense of necessity that nobody else will do it, but also because they have a sense of duty to the communities that they live in. It might seem strange to some people that they're volunteers, that it's not entirely professional firefighters who do this, but the reality is that Australia is a vast country. Some of these communities are incredibly isolated. You need to have people on standby, ready to go. Having a professional firefighting service of 200,000 people, it's extraordinarily expensive to have that on standby.
We've seen the incredibly dramatic images of the conditions that these people are working in. They are unquestionably heroes. Who is leading the debate for them to be paid?
Well, it's the community, really. The community that's so grateful for their service. It's been going on for some time now. It's a regular sight in Australia to see community raffles, barbecues, things like that on the street of people trying to raise funds for people to go back so that these firefighters aren't out of pocket. But something has changed with these fires because they're unprecedented. The scale of them is like nothing we've seen before. They've been burning in some cases for months. What that means is that these volunteers have been out of money in some cases because their workplaces aren't willing to cover them. Somebody else has to come in. These businesses are struggling themselves. So there's a sense that gratefulness isn't enough, that the government has to step it up. It's a very political environment. Now this is being debated by the Prime Minister and the opposition leader.
Henry Bellow reporting. Still to come in this podcast.
The app is being used to track people's conversations, their photos, their location, their relationships, basically everything about them.
So what has happened to Totok following these allegations? We'll find out later. Over the next few days, the BBC is looking at the fate of some of those who have endured long periods of conflict. In a previous podcast, we looked at how legislation relating to a minimum wage in South Africa had an effect on many people. Now to Afghanistan. Mashal Kakar lost her husband, the journalist Sabawoon Kakar, in suicide bombings in Kabul in April 2018. And just days later, she gave birth to her second son. According to Pashto tradition, she was supposed to marry her husband's brother, but she refused and a few months ago fled the country with her children. Now she's seeking shelter in the neighbouring country of Tajikistan, afraid to return home. Some people may find the following disturbing.
When I lost my husband, I was 9 months pregnant and I gave birth to my second son 5 days after the death of my husband. Of course, it's the big tragedy of our life ever. My kids, they lost their father and I lost my love and life partner. We both were very happy because we both were busy with the day jobs. We had professional life. We were going to the picnics. We were going out for dinner. My husband, he was a journalist, and I remember several times while he was coming back from incidents which happened and he was doing the report, he had tear on his eyes and he was crying and he was saying all the time, I'm seeing blood on the street, I'm seeing women and child on the street, and I was always worried about him. And last time while this incident happened with himself, suddenly a message appeared on my mobile and I saw that an explosion happened in Shashtarak, which was close to the office of my husband. While I call him, he answered the phone and he says, usually he was calling me Mashal John, and he says, oh Mashal John, I'm dying. From that time, actually, I was shocked. I didn't know what to do. I just told her, please be strong, I'm just coming. I found him in hospital finally after searching several rooms because there were too many people and every place there was blood and I was running with my big belly. He looked at to my eyes and the first word he says, he told me Benjamin. Benjamin is the name of my elder son. And the second sentence which he told me, that was that, Mashal, I love you a lot. You have to know this, I love you a lot. The doctors took him to the operation room, and after that I didn't see him anymore and I lost him forever. Afghanistan is also one of those countries where the widow women are faced with poverty, social condemnation. After the death of the husband, in according to religion and culture, young widow women are not allowed to live alone in their own home or to be the decision maker of their own life. Widows are either taken back to their original family or the relative of their husbands. Widow woman should marry the second man of husband family. It really doesn't matter for them if she agrees or not. Being the victim of war and wrong culture, it makes me to run away from my country just to make a bright future for my kids and for myself. Currently, I live alone with my two kids in a neighbor country, and I'm looking for UN protection. So now I don't have any other option, just I have to stay here and I should make my life. I'm a person which I born in war and I grew up in war, and still that I am 29 years old. I'm a mother, I have two kids, still the war is continuing. I never want my kids to experience such a thing which I experienced, losing of their family members or loving one anymore. I want them to grow up in a secure place, the place where they could easily go to school, they could continue their education. They should not be victim anymore.
Mashal Kakar, formerly from Kabul, but now living in Tajikistan. The Russian president was seen driving a train on Monday.
Добрый день, дорогие друзья. У нас сегодня с вами приятное.
Today we have a pleasant and a very important occasion for Crimea, for Sevastopol, the whole of the south of Russia, and the whole country, because infrastructure projects such as the landmark bridge that you have built have impact on the whole economy.
Vladimir Putin officially opened the railway bridge connecting Russia's Taman Peninsula with Crimea, the Ukrainian territory annexed by Moscow in 2014. The bridge covers 19 kilometres across the Kerch Strait. Olga Ivshina is from the BBC Russian service.
It is very important for Russia, of course. It has a number of reasons. One of them is purely political, because Russia wants to show and establish and re-establish, you know, how strong it is, and show to the people who live in Crimea and all over Russia that they're not like Ukraine, you know, they take care of Crimea, things are being built. And that's what Putin likes to underline, you know, during these hard times for Russian economy. Many people are really struggling nowadays in Russia to keep their level of living. But he keeps telling that, you know, please keep your patience. So, you know, so many things are being done. For example, we built a bridge, we built a number of airports. That's another way to underline that one. That's a way to show Crimeans that he takes care of them. But also economically, of course, it's very important, because Crimea is technically cut off Ukraine, and there is no other way to link it with Russia other than this bridge. So it will be way easier for Russia to supply goods to Crimea and services, and also tourists. Since 2014, basically, there was no railway connection from mainland Russia to Crimea, to the annexed peninsula. Now they have this chance. So many people who would like to, and, you know, many Russians love taking overnight trains and going, for example, to Crimea, like to various places. Now they can do it to Crimea.
And we get an idea of just how important it is to President Putin. The fact that they managed to build it, even though all the companies that were involved in building it had sanctions imposed on them.
But, you know, basically he didn't count costs. And that's, there are different ways to look at it. On the one hand, yes, they managed to do it despite all the hardships. Crimean Bridge was extremely expensive, expensive to the way that, you know, some people say, is it built out of gold? And just wanted to add some non-political fact that someone who was definitely extremely happy today was a cat called Bridgy, Mostik in Russian. So that cat has been living there since they started building Crimean Bridge, and today he was granted permanent residence at that bridge, despite that the, you know, construction site is over.
That was Olga Ivshina. Now, there's one tech story that's been getting a lot of attention. It relates to a New York Times investigation about a messaging app called Totalk, not to be confused with the Chinese video sharing app TikTok, which is different, obviously. The report alleges that Totalk is basically a spying tool for the government of the United Arab Emirates. Sam Sheed from BBC Tech explains what the investigation has revealed.
So the New York Times story, it basically says that Totalk is spying on citizens in the Middle East, in the United Arab Emirates, as well as other countries. It says that the app is being used to track people's conversations, their photos, their location, their relationships, basically everything about them.
And how popular is it?
It's been very popular in the Middle East over the last couple of months. It's got millions of users. So the United Arab Emirates is the main market for this app, but it's also quite popular in India, and it was one of the most downloaded social apps in the US last week as well.
And it's been taken off Google's Play Store and Apple's App Store. Is it expected to return anytime soon?
So Google removed the app last Thursday, and then Apple removed it on Friday. Both companies say that they are investigating the app. Who knows if it will return?
Sam Sheed from BBC Tech. And so far, there has been no comment regarding the allegations. Now, here in Britain, we are deep into our seasonal festivities, and for many, Christmas wouldn't be Christmas if you didn't get to raise a toast with friends and family in the local pub. But over the last 20 years, the number of small pubs in the UK has halved. The government's promised to give more than $1.3 million to community groups working to rescue or reopen their locals. Our rural affairs correspondent Claire Marshall visited two villages in southern England and spoke to pub goers who clubbed together to try to stop them closing for good.
Remember coming up over the hill and people sitting there?
Yeah.
You couldn't wait to park your car up.
That's right,
and
yeah.
Just walk in and have a chat.
There's no cosy Christmas cheer at the Rising Sun in Woodcroft. It closed 9 years ago. It's a shuttered, cobwebbed ghost of a pub. Jerry Jerram is in his 80s. He used to drink here all the time.
Most of my evenings are spent alone, where you could be spending it down the pub having a game of crib or darts or something, and just chatting.
He and Lim Fletcher are part of the community group Save Our Sun. A decade on and they're still battling the property developer who owns it.
Whenever we've had a big battle, we have won it.
From the New Forest to Somerset, the Packhorse Inn, where festive drinks are being poured, there were nearly office desks, but locals raised more than £1 million to buy it. The new government money is welcome, but volunteer Gerard Crowe says planning rules must be changed.
This as a house would be worth a lot more money than as a pub. So while pubs can be closed and turned into offices or houses, people are going to be tempted to cash in and get the money.
Communities working together are helping to bring life back to their locals, and so far, none of them has gone bust.
That report by Claire Marshall. I've just popped out for a quick one with friends. Champagne, obviously. That's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this edition, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, cheers. Oh, and goodbye.
Hello, this is Kevin Fong from 13 Minutes to the Moon, and I've got a present for you. Our award-winning podcast telling the epic story of the Apollo 11 moon landing was beautifully accompanied by the music of Oscar-winning composer Hans Zimmer. In a special extra episode, Hans will be telling us how he wrote the theme.
All we're doing with the music is we're opening the door a little crack and say, okay, now let your imagination run free.
And you can even download the track for free. That's 13 Minutes to the Moon from the BBC World Service. Search for 13 Minutes to the Moon wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't heard the series yet, you'll find it all there.
When you're not opening presents this holiday season, try smashing your way through some tricky chocolate-coated levels on Candy Crush Saga. In between dinner and dessert, switch and match. During one of Uncle Mike's long stories, master the candy. There are thousands of levels to play in the all-time favorite classic Match 3 game. Get that sweet feeling this holiday with Candy Crush Saga. Download it now from the App Store or Google Play for free.